So welcome to episode 44, live from my drum room with Dave DiCenzo. It's a pleasure to see some folks watching. Coming to you live, by the way, from Martha's Vineyard, and so far so good with the Wi-Fi internet connection here. So what can I say about Dave DiCenzo that a lot of you guys probably don't already know? Just a phenomenal all-around musician, just complete musician as a player, as an educator, as a composer, and add to that just an amazing human being, just one of my most absolute favorite people, and drummers. So I won't take up any more time. I'm going to welcome my good friend and the very handsome Dave DiCenzo.
You hear me, John?
I hear you, Dave.
I hear you too.
And you are very handsome. Let me just before we get started here. You're letting your hair grow too, I see. I meant to mention that earlier.
Oh yeah, all that thick, luscious hair on the top of my head is growing back.
Well, I feel like you had it. Didn't you have it shaved for a while, or am I imagining that?
No, I did. I basically shave it and then let it grow as long as I can before it starts looking dumb, and then I shave it again.
I think it looks great.
Is your voice feeding back? I mean, bouncing back at you?
I'm hearing a little bit of an echo. Yeah.
What the heck that is, man?
Yeah.
I was just Googling it to try to figure something out. And it says if you're hearing the echo, it's not on your end. Like it's not anything that you're doing. So.
But I'm not hearing you. I'm not hearing you in the echo. I'm just hearing my vocal.
That's strange.
I wish it was you and not me. Just because I can't stand hearing my voice coming back to me, but hopefully
it's distracting. I know.
Yeah. But hopefully the guys watching, Anthony, Dan, and the rest of you guys, you're not hearing my voice echo, right?
Yeah. Give us a little chat.
Yeah. Give us a little feedback on that. But we got quite a bunch of folks watching already, Dave. This is great.
Nice.
And, you know, you've seen, I don't know if you've ever watched one of these, but it's, I make a couple of notes ahead of time, but
sure.
Really just a hang and a chat.
That's what it seems like. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't been able to watch too many because I'm usually, you know, busy on it. Usually do them on Saturdays, right?
I have been, yep.
Yeah. So I've seen a couple. I saw the Steve Smith one. That was really cool. I saw that Rick Marotta one, which was funny as hell and cool. And I think I've seen one other one or clips, you know, bits of other ones. But yeah, so I'm hip. I know what the John DeChristopher podcast is like.
I know, you know what you're in for. Well, I may have to call Batman and Robin in. I know them.
John,
we're tight.
John, I'm going to put these, if it's the same, I'm just going to put the in-ears back in, okay?
Yeah, do that. Absolutely. Do what's comfortable. And I'll keep talking.
Boom, 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 boom.
Yep, and it's still there.
Okay. Do, 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 do. All right. All right, John.
Good. So here we go.
Yeah, brother.
We'll edit out all the talk about echoes. So we were talking off camera, off the air, about your dad, and I was going to get into that a little bit later anyway. But I wanted to ask you, I know he was your first teacher, to just talk about like the impact that he had on you as a drummer himself. Growing up and that sort of an influence it had.
Well, one of the things that is that I've been thinking about a lot since he died is how like my, you know, I think a lot of us who are musicians, and I suppose you could say this about other, I'm sure you could say this about other occupations as well, but my whole life, including my social life and like all my friends, everything has been based around music. And I'm just so grateful. Like he was the first one in the family. Like there were no musicians in the family before him. Mm-hmm. And so in one way, just by the nature of, the way things played out, so to speak, him being a drummer and a teacher, and him teaching in the home, the house I grew up in, and I took an interest. And so what I'm trying to say is, in one sense, it was just by nature of our relationship. He was my dad. I was his son. And I followed that path into music. And I've been thinking to myself, I wish I just said to him, thank you, just thank you for, I'm so grateful for you having started all this, started this family, path to music. So just, again, just by nature of our relationship, he influenced me my entire life. And from here till the day I die, I feel like, he lit a torch and sort of lit the way. And it's, I'm just really grateful for that. So in that sort of indirect way, if you will, huge and everlasting influence. And then in more direct and personal way, he was just so supportive, obviously. I mean, him being a drummer himself, and he was very supportive. He was, you remember, at the first time I played the Montreal Drum Festival, he drove all the way up there with his buddy, Rick.
Yeah.
Just to support me. And actually he did it again. I think 2 years later, I was back up there with my band and he came as well, as did my two brothers.
The whole John family. Sales. I think maybe your uncle too.
That was Rick. That was my.
Oh, that was Rick.
That was my dad's buddy, Rick Costa.
Yeah.
And just so supportive, and he was a very organized guy. He was very disciplined, and as a teacher, he, being both organized and disciplined, and he wasn't just dispensing knowledge. He was a creative guy, and he talked about music. He didn't just talk about drumming. He talked about us being musicians, and he gave me, as well as anybody who studied with him, a well-rounded start. So many teachers out there, when they have a new student, a beginner, they don't have the patience or the wherewithal or whatever it is, the desire to give that well-rounded perspective. And it's so important, because it's like, this is your first foray into this potential career path. If not even just, you know, a lifelong hobby, you know? And so that's one of the greatest things, I think he's done for all of his students is give them that good footing, that solid footing from the beginning. And, you know, other than that, I just as a person to person, he was a great hang, as you know. He was a real loving guy, and you know, I hope I learned from that. He's extremely humble person, but you know, confident enough to do what needed to be done to provide and raise a family. You know, I don't know if he came out of the womb this way or he learned this, but he was, you know, you see it when I post on Facebook, for example, you know, when I post something about him, and it's just like this outpouring, of love comes in the comments. And, you know, when we had his celebration of life, hundreds of people showed up, and his, you know, his wake, there were hundreds and hundreds of people showed up. So he just really put a lot of love out there. And I've been influenced by that. You know, I think that's a beautiful thing. The mm-hmm. world needs more people like that. And I'm hoping to carry on not just the drumming tradition in the family, but that aspect of it too, the human aspect of it. Yeah.
That's beautiful, Dave. That's beautiful. And as we said off camera, you know, I've just been thinking so much about your dad. You know, it's interesting. Even I remember when he opened the store in 1982, I was working at Wurlitzer Music. And I'll just back up a second. I met your dad around 1980 when he was working for Harris Vandel or one of the local distributors.
Yeah.
Like Grossman, I think, turned into Harris Vandel.
Yes.
Or something like that. And so I knew Dick as this legendary local teacher that a whole bunch of people that I, you know, customers and people that I knew on the South Shore had studied with, who was still an active teacher at the time.
Yeah.
Was coming in and he was like, we'd order, you know, Remo heads and sticks and things like that from him. And then he opened the shop in 1982.
And you were at Wurlitzer at the time? Is that what
I was at Wurlitzer at the time.
Yeah.
And to give you an idea of how much everybody loved him, here's a guy opening a drum shop only, I don't know, how far is Quincy from downtown Boston? 10 miles?
Yeah,
maybe 10 miles. Everybody was so happy that Dick DiCenzo was opening a drum shop. You know what I mean? It's my boss at the time, this guy Larry Green, your dad was working at getting the Ludwig line, but couldn't get it the day he opened, but he'd already had customers wanting to buy Ludwig from him. So we were getting Ludwig for him and just selling it to him at cost.
No kidding.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember this. And just stuff like that. So I, all these different 6 degrees of separation type things, but it's summertime now. And I saw what you said about your dad on Father's Day and knowing that we were going to be doing this today, I start thinking about your dad. And I have all these just great memories of him, you know, just of our early relationship in that regard, where he would call me and say, you know, that voice, that baritone, "Hey, Johnny, it's Dick DiCenzo. Just checking on that, on the, you know, the order, the Ludwig order or something." And in those days too, Wurlitzer didn't pay its bills. So we were like on credit hold and I'm having to explain to your dad and he understood, but he wasn't happy. Like he totally, he's like, "Oh gee, any idea when I can," I said, "Well, I'm trying to get them to pay the bill so we can release that and some other customer stuff." And so, you know, it all worked out in the end. But
I didn't know that, John. I didn't know you knew him prior to Zildjian, like prior to you working at Zildjian.
Yeah. Well, and then when this is about you, not about me, but I actually started to really get to know him when I moved back from LA in 88 and I was working for DW and I would call on him for DW stuff. And that's when I think I first saw you play, but maybe not. I think you seem to recall it was a different time, but I thought you, I remember seeing you doing something with Joe Franco at your dad's store.
So I think you're conflating a couple of different clinics, basically.
Happens when you get old, Dave.
You know what I, you know what I bet you're thinking of is, because when Joe Franco did his clinic at the drum shop, I was going to say I think he did it just by himself. I don't think there was like an opener. And, but I think a year or two before that, I know it was 87. So I don't remember exactly when Joe Franco did his thing, but I know the thing I did was I opened for Jonathan Mover.
Okay. I don't think I saw that. That was in 87, you said.
Yeah.
I was still out there. Okay.
You were still out in LA.
I was still in LA, but I saw you, maybe I saw you do something in 89 on your own. Atomikit.
Yeah. The Gunmetal Gray Atomikit, or was it?
Yeah, white? Yeah. And it was. Okay. I'd heard about you. I hadn't seen you play, but I'd heard about you from a whole bunch of people, and it was completely mind blowing, floored. And you were only 20, maybe at the time, or maybe 21, 20 or 21.
It was 89. I was 21.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably what you're thinking of. Cause I did do, the reason I asked if it was a gray kit or a white kit. Cause I have a crazy, detailed memory of the past. my short-term memory is not as good as it once was, but man, I have memories just embedded deeply from a long time ago. So anyway, that clinic I did with Jonathan Mover, Zildjian, in fact, had loaned me. Oh, I think so. Jonathan was a Tama endorser.
Yeah.
And I did not have an endorsement yet. And so they wanted, Jonathan, I guess they had a kit they were going to provide for Jonathan. Zildjian did. And they sent it to my parents' house where I was still living and practicing in the basement. And I got to practice on this really nice Tama Art Star, those single lugged kit. And it sounded really good. And so I practiced for like a week on that kit before the clinic. And so I remember that was the Jonathan Mover thing. And then I did one on my own a couple years later with that gray kit, which I had bought brand new in 89.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I'm conflating.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was a bunch of freaking curly haired, long haired, you know, like black haired drummers. Between me, Mover, and Joey Franco. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. I just tried switching my mic just to see if it would fix it, but it didn't seem to do it.
Oh, okay. John, I'm sorry that's happening. I hope it's not on my end.
No, I don't think it is. John Medeiros says there's an echo when I speak, my microphone picking up my computer speakers. No, because the sound is coming through my earbuds, not through the computer speakers. But anyway.
What makes me think it's on my end is this has never happened for you before, right?
Yeah, but there's a first time for everything, Dave. So I have to tell you another quick story about your dad. So Carlos Guzman from the Bat Cave. Okay. So that same year that I moved back from LA working for DW in 88, I'm visiting your dad's store. Johnny, my son, who's maybe your biggest fan in the world, who was 18 months old, I wanted to buy him a Remo Junior Pro drum set. And it was around, I don't know, early December, and I couldn't find one anywhere. Remo didn't have any. I called Rick Drum out there and Lloyd McCoslin, all the friends I had at Remo, and they're like, oh, you know, we're back ordered or blah, blah, blah. I call your dad, and I think he said something like, you know, Johnny, boy, yeah, they're, I have some coming in, or they're hot, or whatever it is, you know, hard to get. I know I got a phone call a day or two later and said, I have one here for you. If you know. And he never really told me what he did, but he figured something out. I was so excited. I drove down there. I got it. And it was, he was the only guy that could make it happen. I feel like I called some other local dealers and people that I was calling on, and they were all kind of like laughing. Are you kidding me? You know,
this was Christmas time.
Yeah. Christmas time. Yeah. So,
yeah. You know, I've heard a good, you know, handful of two over the years, stories over the years like that, you know, just him coming through for people and, you know, people relaying stories like that, how grateful, like, even if it was just like, you know, some tension screws that were period specific or something, you know, like dorky, like drum nerd stuff where people are pulling their hair out, trying to find something. And my dad came through.
Yeah. No, he was, I guess to your point too, you know, he's so organized and, you know, dependable. I think about like when you were talking about, we do clinics and things like that with him, and he was so detail oriented, like right down to exactly when things were going to arrive and what, you know, just all that stuff.
He was, I would say, borderline OCD about that stuff. Just, on top of everything. I have in the other room, he used to put out this thing called the Drumogram.
Yeah.
You know? And man, he and my mom put so much time into those mailers, you know, they were mailers, you know, and really extensive, and any clinics that had happened, he incorporated them into the Drumogram with text, and it was just, you know, a lot of effort. He put a lot of effort into doing the best that he could do, and again, I just, so much of that effort, that caring that he put out, it just all keeps coming back. You know, it made an impact. He really was kind of a rock star on the South Shore of Boston. So
absolutely. Yeah. And even beyond too, it's cool to see so many people like Ralph Angelillo up in Montreal, as you mentioned, you know, the Drum Fest, who got to know your dad through having you there, and people learned of his legendary status on the South Shore, kind of around the world, you know.
You know, that's true. I think of like doing clinics in different parts of the States, for example, where at meet and greets people would come up to me and say, you know, I had your dad's book back in the, you know, the early 70s, and that was like the book. That was the main book I taught out of, you know.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. He published his first book in 1971. Well, his only book, but he updated. He did an updated edition in the 80s, I think. But in 71, he published this book called The Practical Workbook, or A Practical Workbook for the Modern Drummer. And, you know, I've published two books, and I'm finishing up a third right now. And I would give my stuff to him, and you know, before I'd publish it and see what he thought. And my God, he would always just like tear my shit apart. Like, you know, you gotta make this more presentable. You gotta do this. You gotta do that. And I'd be like, you know, inside, I'd be like, I don't want to hear that. you know, because I'd be busting my ass trying to, you know, do the best I could. And he would just, you know, he'd set me straight. And at one point, I went back and looked at his book for the first time in a long time. And I was like, wow, this guy, he just, I don't think I'm the best book writer. I think I've written some a couple of good books. I think this third one's going to be my best one. But he had a way of just like, it's hard for me. It's hard to put what I teach in between two, you know, a front and back cover. It's just hard for me. And he just did such an amazing job of it. If you know, you look at that book, and I saw a Modern Drummer review of his book, you know, after he passed. And it's like great review. And the guy even said, I forget who did it, but he said, you know, he mentioned something to the effect of like, this was no easy feat to do what Dick DeCenso did with this book, to something about the expansiveness of it, but the concise and organized manner in which he presented it. And it's true. It's really true. He, I think he was better at it than I was. And well, it's funny, you know, I've got, I've had some younger former students and now colleagues of mine who are writing books. And I've shared some of just direct quotes from my dad, you know, about how to make their product better.
Yeah.
Kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I would go along with everything you said, just in terms of how I knew him. Just, he was such a, you know, all those things, organized, detail-oriented, and really knew how to, I remember we would be on the phone. I love the fact that he was old school about stuff too. Like, we'd go over the details over the phone, and he'd want to know if we're talking about Ralph Humphrey, who's coming in for a clinic. He'd say, you know, Johnny, give me some of his background. Give me, you know, I want to, you know, and he would write his own bio for Ralph, you know, to promote it, to put in the Drumogram, you know, and those kinds of, and he really took it so seriously because he wanted to present to his students, to his customers, to everybody on the South Shore, like the best clinic and the best event. And it was at a time when, you know, people really took that seriously. Like, it was a really important thing, education. And that's the other thing too. He was always very education oriented when it came to drum clinics. He didn't want necessarily, and this is no reflection on anybody, but someone that was maybe the most popular drummer of the day. He wanted someone that was going to impart information and knowledge to his students and his customers. Yeah. You know, I dug that so much.
One thing that comes to mind just now is, as you were talking, so I just spent the weekend with my mom, and she pulled out a box of his memorabilia that I've never seen. And a lot of it was like, you know, he was on community auditions. There's a ticket stub from 1955 of him. Wow. You know, this guy, he was 14 years old in 55. His parents didn't own a car. So I don't know how he got into Boston to do the show, but like, he made it happen at 14 years old, you know? and then there's a letter from the people at community auditions, you know, how much they enjoyed his performance. Like, I don't know if he won or what it was, but, and then there's like early documents, that my dad saved from, like the Quincy Glee Club, where he had performed and won a scholarship, you know, towards furthering his education and music. And it just occurred to me when you were talking that, like, I think drumming and music Not to sound, it's almost a cliche, but I think in a way it, I don't know if I'd say it saved his life, but it, I think, you know, it gave him purpose. And I think he had to fight for it a little bit. I think he was supported, but by his parents. In fact, I know he was. But I don't know. I guess I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to say, but I know that it was really important to him. Music and drumming and I think he was very grateful. That's what I'm trying to get. I think he was very grateful that he found music, and I know it gave him it was a very prominent driving force in his life, throughout his life, and I think that had probably a lot to do with why he was so fervent in spreading it to as many people as he could, as well as he could.
Yeah.
You know,
that's makes perfect sense, Dave. That's very interesting too. Yeah. And that's just what he did too. I mean, it was like a contagious thing with him. Yeah, it really was.
And then you said earlier, like he was so serious about it. And then, which was true, and then at the end of the day, he would let his hair hang down. He was a good, he was a good hang.
He was a great hang.
He was a great hang.
I have to tell you, I may not have told you about this. If Jerry Donegan is watching this, he could be, because he watches a lot of these. Jerry Donegan is an old friend of mine from Zildjian. He was the vice president of sales for many, many years. I worked at Zildjian almost 40 years, but right after your dad sold the shop to South Shore Music,
yes,
still DeCenzo's drum shop, he was still involved. We were planning the Steve Gadd clinic that we had there in 2007, maybe, I think it was.
In Quincy,
yeah. I think you came toward the end. You had a gig, or you were somewhere, and I think you made it. I saw you afterward.
Yeah.
I feel like, yeah. Well, so, yeah, some months before that, Jerry Donegan, myself, your dad, and Peter.
Volpe.
Sorry, Peter, if you're watching. Peter Volpe of South Shore Music went to lunch at a place that your dad loved to go to in Quincy, kind of right off the highway. Yeah, do you know the place I'm talking about? Near Furnace Brook Parkway.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm trying to remember the name of it.
I couldn't. Yeah, like an old school great restaurant on a Friday afternoon. And we drank martinis at like 1 in the afternoon on a school day. On a school day. And I think Peter was the only smart one who kept it to 1. And I think Jerry and your dad and me went for the second round and we weren't feeling anything. My wife is not far away, and she's probably going to yell at me later for this. But we drank lots of coffee, and we were make sure to be okay. We were okay to drive home. But anyway, that was maybe the last sort of old time sort of hang we had like that. You know, where he really let his hair down, like you said. Just so many laughs, and yeah.
We're not trying to promote, you know, alcohol here.
No,
folks, but. No. When my dad had a couple, it's like, you know, it's just what do they call that? A lubricant. Like he just was.
Yeah.
He would get silly, you know, all that seriousness would just like.
Yeah.
Go out the window. And he loved telling jokes. He was a good joke teller. When I got married, my bachelor party, I didn't want to do a sort of typical bachelor party. I just had my dad and a couple of my closest friends. and we hung out. We went out for a nice Italian meal at a place called, I forget what it was called. It was a great Italian restaurant on, I think it was on 3A in North Quincy. Tullio's, I think it was called. Mm. And then we went back to my apartment in Milton. And we pulled an all-nighter. He slept over. He called my mom at like 2 in the morning, all pie-eyed. I have a picture of him on the phone, all pie-eyed with this big shit-eating grin on his face, talking to my mom, saying, "I'm not coming home tonight."
I never heard that. That's outstanding.
So much fun. Yeah, he could really hang. I love talking about my dad, and I want to share this too. Maybe it's just kind of selfish, but I wished that I told him before he died how much I appreciated the path that he laid out, that I didn't have to go down that path, you know, but I wanted to. And he laid that out. And I wish I had really expressed that to him, just looked him in the eye and at one point and just said, "Dad, I just want to thank you." Cause you know, a lot of the time that he and I hung out, He would be all business. He'd be asking me about how my books were going and how the gig's going and what's new. And it was at a time where I remember specifically a period of time where I was just like, I don't know that I ever said this to him, but Dad, but in my mind I was like, "Dad, I don't want to talk about business and, you know, music." Mm. But I think he got the, I think he got that impression, like that maybe I just, you know, I just didn't really want to talk about it. And I think it was a period of time in my life. Like right now, I'm in kind of a nerdy phase, if you will, where I like talking drums and I like talking shop. And there was this long stretch where I had just was so out of that headspace. And so, you know, I told friends at the time, like, you know, I have this great friend, Bill, who is just a mad scientist thinker. And he's always thinking and taking me to places that I'm like, "Dude, I never even thought of that," you know. And even with Bill, there was a time during this time, I was like, "Bill," he'd ask me a question and I'd, my brain would just get like start to tie itself in a knot. And I'd be like, "Billy, I can't do this right now. I don't want to think this hard. And if I'm going to think this hard, I don't want it to be about drums right now." Hmm. So I went through this period and I, you know, by the time I came out of it, my dad was sick. Hmm. And within the period of time between finding out he was sick and him actually dying was 5 months. It happened really fast. So there was, and in that 5 months, me and my two brothers and our significant others were like conference calling, you know, and searching online for alternative thing. And just like everything for that 5 months went into how can we save his life? You know, is there anything we can do? And in hindsight, you know, probably wouldn't do it any differently if it happened again, but it would have been nice to maybe take some of that time and just like been with him. And talked with him, my point is, I wish that I could have shown more appreciation for him to his face while he was alive. And that is a regret. And I'm okay with regrets. You know, the people say don't have any regrets. And I don't think I could do that. I do have some regrets. And that's one of them. And, you know, I don't know. Somehow I think that's why I said this might be a little selfish, because I just wanted to express that out openly, you know.
Yeah. I totally understand what you're saying, Dave, and if you'll permit me to say it, I think you thanked your dad so many times in so many ways. I was there for a lot of these times. I mean, I remember Pasek 1991 at Disneyland in California.
Wow.
When you, yeah. Probably the, you know, I don't care who's watching, it's probably the greatest drum solo I've ever seen played at a Pasek. Ever, and that I will ever see, and that is on tape somewhere, right?
I have that on VHS somewhere, you know.
Okay, you should put that out, because I'm not imagining that. That was like otherworldly.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome. In fact, you probably never played that great again. No, it really was. It was. No, it wasn't downhill. It was off the friggin' chain. It was unbelievable.
I can I share something with you about that day?
Yeah.
This is a good memory. So after I did my performance, and I think after the whole competition was over, I'm in the bathroom, and I'm going to the bathroom at the, you know, I'm at the urinal, and Ed Sof walks in.
Oh.
And he's like, he steps up a couple urinals over, and we look at each other, and he's like, "Hey man, that was great." You know, something like that. And he's like, "You know, you made Harvey Mason go, woo, when you were doing that, when you were playing." And he said, "When Harvey goes, woo, you know you're a badass." And I was like, "Thanks, you know, thanks, man. You know, I really appreciate that." I just thought that was a funny story. Like Ed and I go in the bathroom next to each other, having a
moment in the men's room.
Yeah, and I didn't know Ed. I mean, I knew of him, but you know,
sure.
I didn't know who he was. So yeah, well, thanks, John. Yeah, and my dad was there for that. He, you know, he, you know, I could have gone out to Pasek by myself. He could have, you know, he didn't have to go. He wanted to go, you know,
right.
And I'm so glad he did.
Dave, I remember he was beaming. We were all beaming. We were all, but he was, I mean, think about it. If Leo went out and did a, you know, played in a competition and just completely floored everybody, what you'd feel like. And your dad was just,
yeah, I can imagine.
He was beaming. And I think like years later, like we talked about Montreal Drum Fest and he came when you played by yourself that first time. And then when Two Ton Shoe came up, yeah, it was, that's, those are such proud moments for a dad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And such great, great memories for a son. I'll give you another one. In 1988, I went to the Drummers Collective. And I was going to do a certificate program, and I ended up just studying privately with
Kim Plainfield.
With Kim, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
With Rod Morgenstein, with Frank Malabe, Ricky Sebastian. Who else? There were a couple other guys. You know, I was going to do this certificate program, but then within the first week, I was like, you know, I don't want to do this. And they allowed me to just put all the money I had paid for the certificate program to private lessons. So I just took private lessons for like 2 months while I was there. And,
was Zach there? Zach Danziger?
Zach, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
he was 17, I want to say.
Yeah.
I was 19 or 20. And oh, so here's a good story. So the director, a guy named Brad Flickinger, I think his last name was. It's the first day. And I don't remember if I had, you know, classes that day or what was going on. I just remember being in the lobby and Brad walking out from behind the desk and taking me to this room and where Zach was. And he opened a cage door and just threw me in with a lion. It was like, go hang out with a lion, dude. And so this was like I said, 88. So just, you know, a couple years prior, Chick Corea's Electric Band album had come out and I was a little late to the party. So I just was getting into it in like 87. And this was the first time in my life at that point where I had heard music that I was interested in, that I liked. I was like, this is cool. And I didn't know what the drummer was doing. Because prior to that, you know, I could figure out Neil Peart. I could figure out pretty much anything that I had encountered except for jazz, which I was still confounded by at this point. But I didn't care. Like when my dad was listening to jazz records, you know, I was like, I had these, you know, like, you know, novice thoughts, thoughts of a novice. Like, how do these guys know where they are? You know, what's going on here? Like, you know, why is this so long and where's the melody? And, you know, I was a product of 70s radio. You know, my mom had a frickin' transistor radio on top of the fridge. It was on WBVF, I think it was. Or ROR. Like, it was two stations. And you heard everything from Stevie Wonder to The Who to the, like, Commodores. It's like, everything, you know, everything that had a backbeat, you could hear on one station. And I loved it. I was all about the melodies. I didn't even care about the drumming so much yet, you know. I was all about the melodies and the harmony. And so I just didn't understand jazz, but I didn't care. So Weckl and on that Chick Corea album, and maybe Gad just before that on the Friends album. I think my brothers had hit me to that. I didn't understand it. And so now Brad throws me in with Zach, and there's this kid like playing all that shit with his own, like Zach's got an attitude, and, you know, we all do, I suppose, you know, we all play who we are. So he was doing all that shit, but there was definitely he was putting his own little slant on it. And then we all know where Zach went. Like, Zach just went, pew, like he could have been, you know, fusion star drummer, you know, of the 80s and the 90s. But he went in his own direction, but he hadn't gone in that direction yet. So he's playing all that shit. And I was just like, Brad sent me into trade fours. That's what it was, Zach. And after a few go arounds, I was like, I just stopped. And I was like, do you mind if I just listen to you? And I think I had my Radio Shack realistic tape recorder as well. It was like this big. I used to bring this frickin' thing everywhere to like the Bottom Line and to Chris, to the 55 bar, this hunk of frickin' plastic. And I'd record, you know, it was the first time I saw Dennis Chambers and Dennis, you know, Dennis was like one of the first ones, if not the first, that gave me the impression to myself, like, you know, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can do this. Mm-hmm. Maybe, because I still didn't understand the Weckl Gad thing. And it was predominantly the Afro-Cuban Brazilian influences that they were bringing into the fusion drumming that they were doing. It was that stuff that I didn't quite get.
Yeah.
But Dennis wasn't doing so much of that. It was more like backbeat and occasional swing. So yeah, man, you know, I think I still have a lot of these tape recordings. In fact, I would go down to this place on Bleecker Street to see Zach play with Hiram Bullock every, like, you know, he had a house once a week, you know, like a Thursday night, something or other. And, yeah, I'd go down there with my hunk of plastic and record and, you know, go back to my boarding house room. I lived in this boarding house for like however long I was there, like 2.5 months. And I'd listen and I'd try to transcribe and stay up all night, you know, just nerding, trying to get the stuff. So that was a significant memory too. Is you're right. Yeah. Zach was there and I was
great experience.
I was blown away by him.
Yeah. And you know, to your point about Dennis, you have more ability in your a quarter of your fingernail than I could ever dream to have. But my first impressions of hearing Dennis is similar to what you're saying in that the stickings, you could sort of understand what he was playing. You know, like whether it was singles or doubles and his jazz beat, but it was the speed at which he played it at that was so mind-boggling to hear someone play at that time. Other than Billy Cobham on records, I'd seen Billy maybe one or two times, but seeing Dennis in a small club and playing all that stuff. Whereas like you say, Dave and Steve, they were playing these really new kind of, to fusion anyway, rhythms that you didn't typically hear.
Yes.
So yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And, Frank Malabe, again, God rest his soul too. He died a long, long time ago, died a young man. He hipped me. And actually Zach, I think helped me too. Just, you know, hipping me to these rhythms, these African, predominantly African rhythms, and how they were being put on the drum set by these different drummers. That helped a lot in decoding what I was hearing. You know, and mind you, 1988, you know, I showed up with long hair, ripped jeans. I remember my dad saying to me, you know, David, you know, son, I don't know if you're making the best impression, you know, wearing these ripped jeans, you know, going to the collective. And, you know, I was full on metal. I was like just really headlong into metal. And that was like, in hindsight, that was my metal sort of stage. I eventually moved away from that. But, and I remember Rod Morgenstein showing up to our first lesson, and he had ripped jeans on. I called my dad, and I told him, I was like, "You'll never believe what Rod Morgenstein was wearing at us at our first lesson today."
And, that's such a 20-year-old kid thing, you know, it's perfect.
So, and more to the point though, is like, I was just, you know, it's like music is like, different styles of music are like different accents on the same language. You know, you know, like Scottish people. I remember my first European tour, I had a Scottish tech. And this guy was speaking English and I understood maybe 10% of what he was saying all the time. So it's kind of like that, you know, he's speaking English, like Gad playing his Mozambique was speaking rhythm, speaking drum language, but I didn't get the accent, you know, I didn't get that vernacular. And so going to the collective at that time, being sort of set in a certain way and being good at, like I could play that way and I was well practiced at that. It's, it was almost like culture shock in a way, you know, being exposed to all that stuff and then doing the work to be able to speak with that accent in that vernacular. And it took me a while. You know, I came home after that and I had my songos and my Mozambiques and my wawancos and all this stuff and the batucada and the bayao. And here's a good story too. Before I even got back, one day I'm in a practice room and I'm working out all my Afro-Cuban Brazilian stuff. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I was feeling good about it. And I walked out of the room after, like, you know, I was sweating and I was in there for a couple hours. I finally take a break. I walk out of the room and this guy, this French guy who was one of the students there, he was older than me by about 5 years. And he says thoughtfully, he says, you know, Dave, you know, everything you play sounds like rock. And I was like, okay, you know, I don't even remember how I responded, but I remember not fully understanding what he was saying. And it took me a couple of years to realize that, to recognize what he was saying.
Yeah.
And he was spot on. You know, it's like you can learn the words of a different vernacular, if you will, but that doesn't mean you're going to sound, you know, authentic. Mm-hmm. And so that was really a great experience for me in terms of being the beginning of me really evolving beyond, you know what, I don't want to say that because it sounds condescending, but just becoming a more well-rounded musician, it wasn't easy. But it was fun. So anyway, that was a great experience. The collective was awesome. Kim Plainfield was awesome. He eventually became a good friend of mine, actually, when he eventually came to teach at Berklee. And I was teaching there already. Just going out at night in the village, I could walk anywhere I wanted to go or take a train,
right?
And see, I saw Peter Erskine for the first time, our buddy, yeah. Peter.
Yeah.
Dennis, Danny Gottlieb. I saw him for the first time. Joel Rosenblatt. I saw Joel play with Michelle Camilo. And that was really, you know, so that was like, so like I said, I wanted to become a fusion drummer. I wanted to be able to play like Weckl and Vinny and those guys doing that and Rosenblatt, who I'd never even heard of at the time.
What a monster. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a great guy too. Yeah. So I told him that, you know, I ran into him a couple years ago he actually came up to me. If I remember correctly, he came up to me and was like, man, you're such a monster. And I was like, Joel Rosenblatt, man, like I saw you, you know, 30 years ago, man, and you blew me away. And he was so humble. And but yeah, man. So, you know, that was like right exactly where I wanted to be, you know, going to see a guy like Joel Rosenblatt playing all that shit with Michelle Camilo. So anyway, and I think how we got here was my dad took me, you know, we took the Amtrak train down like a month before I was to go, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe he just went there with me and then left me there and went home. But I remember I had forgotten this completely. A friend of mine who now lives in New York City, he's recently moved there with his family. He took a picture of a cross street that he was on, and one of the cross streets was Tito Puente Way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just shot me back to that night, to that time when my dad took me down to New York. He took me to the Blue Note down in the Village, and we saw Carmen McRae, and the other show we saw at the Blue Note within that same like couple day time span. You know, and that speaks to the man as well. Like, he didn't just take me down and make sure I was cool and situated. He like took me out too, and he made plans to like. You know, he got the tickets and we went and saw Tito Puente's full band.
Oh, man.
At the Blue Note. So, you know,
he was making sure you knew. Yeah, he was totally making sure you knew what you had at your disposal, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is the scene.
And then, you know, prior to that, you know, he took me to see Rush in 1982, I think it was. So I would have been 14, maybe it might have been 83. It was the Signals tour, whatever year that was. Mm-hmm. He got us tickets, 14th row on the floor at the Boston Garden.
Wow.
We were standing on our wooden chairs the whole time.
Yes.
Frickin' like the marijuana was like flowing, like it was a fishbowl, and we're standing on our chairs, man, and Getty's like right there, and Alex is right there, and Neil's right there. And on the way in, we're driving up 93, says, you know, Davey, I'm really excited about tonight, but I wish we were going to see Bonham tonight, because John Bonham had just died, you know, a couple years prior to that.
Right.
So, you know, he knew what I was into, and yet he went and it's like he was culturing me. Like, he went and he didn't take me to go see, you know,
just the guys he liked.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Louis Belson or Peter or any. Yeah.
It's, he hipped me to, you know, Carmen McRae and Tito Puente just in that short little time we had together down in New York in that weekend. So, and again, these are things that I wish that I reflected on and shared with him and just told him how grateful I was. And, you know, I hope he knew, but I could have opened my mouth more and just made sure that he knew. So I'm grateful for him.
I know you are. I know what you're saying. I'm not trying to talk you out of what you're saying about that, but I know that he was just so proud and so knew how much you appreciated what he did for you. I know that. I was thinking about, like, I want to say it was like 30 years ago, seeing you at the Channel with Ultra Blue. Just all these memories of, and I could be imagining either your dad was there or one of your brothers. Like, there was always somebody in your family there. It seemed like when I would go see you with Two Ton Shoes somewhere but Ultra Blue, I want to say that was like such a departure for me to see you that way. It was the first time I saw you playing a bass drum, a snare drum, a hi-hat, and one cymbal. Does that sound right?
That was probably Two Ton Shoe.
So with Ultra Blue, you didn't play the small.
No,
you didn't. Okay, I'm getting
that.
Dave.
That was a little before. That was before. Like, Ultra Blue was, I think I joined that band in '93. No. That was '91 because I joined Fahrenheit in '91. Muzz, our buddy Muzz, went to play with the Fools.
Right.
And Fahrenheit was sort of on its last leg, and they had already been signed and dropped and went through that whole experience. But they were still going. They still had management, and we played all over the place. And I played with them for about 18 months, and I had such a good time. Oh, my
God.
Great
band.
So much fun. It's always been my favorite thing as a drummer has always been to play great songs behind a great singer. And I loved a lot of the Fahrenheit songs, and Charlie Farren is a phenomenal singer.
Yeah.
And so that was so much fun. But anyway, Robert Holmes was playing in Fahrenheit at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and who was, I think Brock Avery was playing drums with Ultra Blue. And I think Brock went west.
That's right. Yeah.
He went west at that time. And so, you know, Robert needed a drummer. And, so yeah, that from about 91 to about 94, 95, I was playing with Ultra Blue. And then a few years later, well, 95, Two Ton Shoe started. And a couple years after that, I went to that two-piece just kick snare hat and a crash ride.
Yeah, okay.
So you must have seen that.
I definitely saw that a bunch of times, and I guess I was, like you say, conflating as usual. But with Ultra Blue, were you still playing maybe a smaller kit than what I remembered from like the Cro-Mags days?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Like definitely a scaled down, maybe a four piece or something.
Yeah, it was like probably a four. Well, I think it was two up, one down. I think it was a five-piece kit. One bass drum, though. I remember there was this, you know, I went through this period where it's so immature in hindsight. It was an immature thing, and I'm cool with it. Like, I'm not, like, beating up on myself. But I had this sort of mission in my head to make people think I was playing double bass when I wasn't.
I think that's cool.
It's cool, but, you know, like, it wasn't necessarily, I wasn't always necessarily making the best decisions for the song, you know? And, you know, more than one person in my early career told me that, you know, they thought I was overplaying, and they were right. You know, I appreciate that. But this was a time, yeah, so it was like a thing in my head, like, I'm no more double bass, you know? I'm just going to go out with one bass drum, one pedal, and at the ends of shows, I'm going to make people come up and say, that was just one bass drum or one pedal. So, you know, my youth.
That's okay.
And it did happen. You know, people would come up to me and say that. So it was like, yeah, mission accomplished. And, you know, it was silly, but that's what was going on. It was like I was kind of into the idea of paring down and you know, making as much happen with as little as possible. And even that, you know, if you're not careful, that can be a mistake, you know. If your mission is just, well, I just want to be able to do, you know, I've seen comments when I was playing that two-piece kit, people saying, you know, I would have thought he was playing, you know, comments on Facebook from back in the day, you know, like remembering back. I would have thought he was playing. I heard Dave, you know, play more shit on a two piece drum set. Than I've heard people play on, you know, a 20 piece drum set. And it's like, is that a compliment? You know, I know they meant it as a compliment, but as you mature, you know, you wonder, well, was that a good thing that you were doing, Dave, or?
But you know what? This is so great because we are talking about shit that is so important for other drummers to know, you know what I mean? And learn. And you're given like a real open, honest assessment of like where you were at that time. And you've looked back at it and thought, yeah, I was young. I was this, I was that. I think this is so great. This is like you're peeling back, you know, the curtain, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Yeah. You know, it's definitely something I can offer. You know, it's something we can all offer if we are reflective and honest with the way how we're reflecting. And, you know, you look back and see what you might have been doing that wasn't necessarily the best choices. And that's one of the great things about teaching. One of the things I love the most about teaching is I can hip a 20-year-old person to something that I didn't figure out until I was 35 or 40 or 45 or even 50.
Yeah.
You know? And
that's great.
Great place to, a great position to be in. I'm grateful for that. Like, it's a privilege. That's the word. It's kind of a privilege to be able to do that, you know? And I kind of get off on it. Like, you know, like I'm giving you something that you can start to utilize now at 20. You know, that's why you're paying me. That's what you're paying me for, that kind of stuff, you know, and that shit's invaluable, you know.
Absolutely.
You should pay for that, you know, at 20 years old, if someone can hip you to that stuff. And, you know, I studied with a couple of, I'm not going to name any names. All my teachers were great. But there was one guy in particular who, you know, he was an awesome teacher, and he's had some of the greatest drummers as students in the world. But he did not offer any of that kind of stuff. You know, it was all very sort of practical, and it was awesome. I learned so much from this guy, but I didn't learn that kind of stuff.
Yep.
From this guy, you know. So anyway,
I know what you're saying.
I'm happy to be in that position.
Yeah, no, and I'll just to put a cap on that. Yeah, I you're talking about, like, in addition to, like you say, practical stuff, you're also imparting like life stuff that is like so huge, which I think is a missing piece of it for some people studying with a teacher, that they're getting all this other great valuable information, but what you're talking about is huge to like. Yeah. Someone who wants to go and do this for the rest of their life as a career and as a living, you've got to know that stuff. Like, have a teacher say, yeah, you know, I did this, but I realized later that, you know, that wasn't going to work. It wasn't maybe the best choice. So however you would say it, I think that's huge. I do.
Yeah. And I don't take that lightly. I really appreciate being in that. I feel fortunate being in that position. And so, you know, life, yes, but in addition to that, like, so there's the practical things that you can impart on people. And then on the other side, there's the human life things, you know, that you can share. And then in the middle of that, there's also just being a good musician.
Yeah.
A good team player, that is, you know, like I make the distinction, and I'm not saying I'm the only one who makes this distinction, but for me, I make the distinction between, you know, being there are a lot of great drummers out there who aren't necessarily great musicians. You could play the shit out of a drum set. Doesn't mean you're a great musician. It means you're a great drummer. And if that's as far as you want to take it, that's cool, you know. But if you want to play with other people, you got to take it further than just having your chops and your vocabulary and your timing. And I would say even your sound. It's got to go beyond all that. And, there was, you know, I heard someone say that way back when I was young, like a teenager, you know, there are no great drummers under the age of 30. And I think my take on that now at 53 is, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Now, that's not entirely true. I mean, Tony Williams was a fucking great drummer. Steve Gadd was a, you know, John Bonham was 20 years old when he made Zeppelin 1.
Right.
Or 21.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so.
No, I think you're right. Right. Yeah.
So while that's not entirely true, there is truth to it. Because I think for most of us, it takes time to get that musical aspect of it. Go beyond just being a great instrumentalist to you know, graduating to becoming a great musician.
Yeah.
And that did take me time, you know, if I look back. Now, you know, but so it's like you could poke holes in almost anything. I could even poke a hole in that further and say, well, you know, I was 22 when I played on this first Cro-Mags record that I did. And that I have a hard time saying this, but I'm just going to say it. I think that was great metal drumming. Like that's the vast majority of the stuff that I've done in my career, I never want to listen to again. There's stuff on YouTube that I will never watch again because I just don't like it. But it's out there, and you know.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to watch it. There are a few things that, you know, I'll go to YouTube every once in a while, and I'll look at it, you know, and be like, "Yeah, Dave, that was some shit, man. You sound good." But there's so much stuff that I'm like, oh my God, it makes me cringe. Like I don't want to watch it. I don't want anybody to watch it, but it's out there. But this, you know, so that Cro-Mags record, you know, I did a good job, you know, and I wasn't 30.
Yeah.
So there's room for play in there. It's like, it's not a hard and fast truth, but there is truth to it. You got to go beyond. If you want to play with, you know, with the musicians, other musicians, you got to go beyond just being a great drummer.
Yeah. And I would just venture to say, Dave, that you're one of those few guys, like you mentioned, you know, Tony and Gad and Bonham, and you put Jeff Beccaro in that category too, of like playing on these records at a young age. But you, and I think a lot of credit certainly goes to your dad for exposing you to all these different styles. But you had this depth by the time you were in your 20s of going beyond being a metal drummer. You know what I mean? Like the Ultra Blue gig or Two-Ton Shoe in the mid-90s. You know what I mean? Before you reached 30, you had already started to expand your palette.
So let's, you know, let's on that point, let's take it a step further then and say, and this is just my opinion of myself.
Yeah.
Yes, I became a versatile drummer in my 20s. But I don't think in terms of metal and hard rock, yeah, I had that shit down, and it wasn't just as a drummer. I was playing musically, and I was serving the music in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as I ventured out into these other styles of music, I think that's where, you know, things like touch and you know, the notes that you don't play and making choices. Like Dave Maddox, our good buddy Dave Maddox, he calls it editing. You know, becoming a good editor. It's like, if you're a writer, you hire an editor. But as a musician, you've got to be your own editor. You know, you can't send the work out for somebody to edit for you. It's like you're making it right there. You've got to make it happen. And that's where I think I know that's where I was, you know, a little short on skill and perspective. I just needed a few more years to get there. So look, I love that you appreciated what I did, and it means a lot to me. And I appreciate what I did too. You know, I'm not just like saying you sucked when you were in your 20s, or except for at metal. You were good at metal. But you know, you know, my motto when I was 20 years old, even when I was 25 years old, was hit the drums as hard as you can, as consistently as you can. And I had people telling me, supporting that, you know, the first like major recording session I did, that at the end of one of the tracks I cut, the engineer was in the control room. He stood up and gave me a standing ovation. And that was really meaningful to me, like really impactful to me, because I was young, I was 19 years old, and you know, we were making a record, you know, and
that's huge.
And I, you know, so that kind of feedback was great. But the along with that, you know, appreciation was what he appreciated was how hard and how consistent I was hitting and how, my timing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like I took that, you know, I took that to heart and I put it in my back pocket. And it was like, yeah, I'm doing the right thing, you know? And when you start stepping out into, you know, like Steve Gadd, your great friend, legendary Steve Gadd, I'm sure he still can. He could fricking lay into those snare drum on 2 and 4. He could hit that front beat on the bass drum too and lay into that shit. But he also could, you know, he and that's one of the things I think that goes into becoming a great musician is adjusting your touch. It's like, you know, you walk into one conversation with a group of people and they're talking about, civil engineering and you know, you have to bring a certain vernacular to that and a certain or another. You're talking to your son about something very delicate and you have to bring a certain, not just vernacular, but a certain tone, a certain touch. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, I think what I was doing, I was bringing my like into everything. So when I was playing with Ultra Blue, I was still in that mentality of like, hit the drums hard all the time. And I just, I don't think that way anymore. And I don't, and you can't just change your thought. You then have to, if you have that realization, then you have to actualize it. You can't just have the thought and then the skills are there automatically, you know? Right. You have to do the hours touching the instruments in a different way. Well, so I think that was part of the process for me.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, Dave, a great example is I have to think playing with Josh Groban. I mean, talk about a discipline, you know, having to have discipline in your playing, right? I mean, that's not a gig. That's a gig where you got to blow in certain instances. You had your moments, but that's a gig where he wants it solid, consistent, dependable. Right. I mean,
that's a good, the Josh Groban gig was a good example. Because, you know, we're doing arena tours.
Yeah.
And I immediately went back to my sort of, okay, we're hitting everything hard and big. But see, that's another thing is I learned how to hit hard with more grace and beauty, I would call it. I'm not trying to blow my own horn, but I know how to play big now.
Yes.
Yep. And not necessarily hard. You know, I can play big and wide now. Whereas I think when I was 20 years old, more of my shit was a little narrower. It was like I was big and, you know, hard versus big and wide. And big and wide implies like you have to take something off of it. You know, it's like you can't just, it's like a baseball player. You can't just swing for the fences and, you know, flex your muscle and go, argh! This like there's a grace to it that you learn. There's a beauty to it that you learn. And so I was able to bring that to the Josh Groban gig. And then at the same time, Josh's gig, you got to be versatile. You know, you got to play brushes. Yeah. I was shaking something in my right hand and playing a brush in my left hand and then dropping that and picking up a stick and keeping this going and then dropping this and playing with two sticks and then picking it back up. You know, stuff like that challenged me in a good way. But you know what? I think probably the thing that is helped me most in terms of my dynamics and my touch was and still is playing smaller places where you actually have a PA. So you're in a small room, but there's a PA, you know, because you could play some sort of small places and there's no PA and you feel like, well, I kind of have to lay into these drums to make sure, even though it's not a huge place, you want to make sure that people over in that far corner are getting you and feeling you. But when you play a small place with a PA, you know, that's where I really feel like my now acquired skills of being able to simmer, play down, but make, I call it like, you know, you want to make the people want to take their clothes off. Like you want it to be sexy no matter what volume it is. You want it to be, you know, visceral no matter what the volume is. And speaking on this topic, again, Peter Erskine was one of my early lessons in on this topic. And I can't believe I've never shared this with Peter. Thanks to you and some other people, I've had, you know, a handful of occasions where I've got to hang with Peter. And I've never told him this, but, you know, he taught me a great lesson without knowing it. Cause at that time when before I was really getting it yet, I went to see Peter at Great Woods and we were late cause we were hanging out in the parking lot and the band started. And so we beelined it and it sounded amazing. It sounded like somebody just turned the most high end massive home stereo on. And
was it Steely Dan?
It was actually the New York Rock and Soul Review, I think.
Oh, okay.
Which was Steely Dan and
Boss Skaggs
and Phoebe Snow. It was such a great show. And anyway, in my mind, as I'm walking in, I'm thinking like Peter must be laying in because I don't remember what song it was, but it was, you know, it was a backbeat, medium tempo. And in my mind, I was projecting what I thought I would have been doing based on what I was hearing, you know, and I could only imagine that that's what Peter was doing. And when we got in, we had lawn seats and so we come in, the stage is down here and I look to my right and Peter's farthest stage left. Mm-hmm. So he's the first thing you see when I walked in and he was, oh, I'm on a short tether here. He was doing this. Never, I don't think he lifted his arm to hit the snare drum the entire night. And there was none of this.
Yeah.
You know, on the hi-hat, it was, you know, if he was playing, you know, it was more of a, like a lateral versus a, you know, a big up and down thing. It was all very like what I call low profile. You know, if you're like looking at someone from a profile, you know, is it a high profile or is it, you know, is it low? And so that's what that's one of the, I'd say, major things that I worked on later, you know, like probably starting in my mid-20s, I started working on that, but it took me a while. Because it's still that old thing still kicks in still to this day.
Yeah,
I want to hit things hard based on what I'm hearing, what I think should happen. But so it's still a work in progress, but I can do it now. Like I know how to, like if you take a picture of me from here up, I know how to make you want to take your clothes off, John, and you won't know I'm doing anything.
I always do when I see you. I mean, I want to. I don't always take them off, but I want to take them off.
You want to, yeah.
I do.
So, yeah, man, I want to move people without moving that much when it's appropriate. You know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't do that so well when I was 20 years old. No.
By the way, I have to tell you, this comment came in a little while ago from our friend Uli Salazar, who sends you big love.
Uli.
You're Ludwig man.
What's up, Uli?
Uli, good to see you, brother. I have to tell everybody too, Dave, because I don't know that this was never anything that was made public to the world, but the big Steve Gadd tribute that Zildjian did in 2003 at Berkeley.
Yeah.
I think you remember this. We had Vinny. Yeah, scared the shit out of you. We had Vinny Colaiuta and my good friend Rick Murata, who we saw last night for dinner, in fact, here on the Vineyard, paying tribute to Steve.
I just want to make that official. I love you, Rick Murata.
I love him too.
Improve your sound.
He's something else.
Go on.
So, and planning this massive event that was 2 years in the planning, and it comes down to, I don't know what it was, a month or maybe even just a matter of a couple of weeks before we come to find out Vinny gets called to do these dates with Sting right before the event, which was September 2003. And so I'm on the phone with Vinny about it, and basically the last date is the day before the show. So Vinny's like, it's cool, I'll get on a plane. I'll be coming from London. I'll get into Boston at whatever time in the afternoon. Do a rehearsal, do the show that night. And it was, and I remember thinking like, oh man, this has problems, potential problems written all over it. So we had this team of people at Zildjian that were putting this event on with myself. And I said, we need to get someone that can be ready to go at a moment's notice and play this show, because we couldn't have all this music that was planned that Vinny was going to play, you know, that was going to honor Steve, without a drummer. So I called you and I scared the shit out of you initially. But I have to tell you, Dave, we had a Rob Wallace, your good friend and mine, and Paul Siegel from Hudson, they were helping produce this. They videotaped it for us. And we had a team of people at Zildjian, all of whom knew you. And everybody agreed that Dave DiCenzo could do this. He could walk in there, let them know what the songs are ahead of time, and he'll play the shit out of it if we have to call on him to do it at the last minute.
So two things. I'm so honored, you know, and flattered that you would think of me in that capacity to be able to, you know, jump in like that and fill in for Vinny. And the other thing is, yeah, it scared the shit out of me, man. Like, I, you know, especially in 2003, I was still something I haven't been talking about that much lately. I've been doing a fair amount of interviews and such. But I had, terrible tendonitis in my wrist and my forearm. It has since gone up into my, they call it bicep tendonitis. And
I forgot about the forearm. Forgot about that.
It really created a lot of problems for me. And a lot of the problems were mental, because it got to my head. Like, I don't know if I'm going to lose, if my hand's going to go numb in the middle of a song, because that shit happened. You know, that was a fairly regular occurrence. And in metal, you know, it sucked, but if I had to, I could hold the stick, like, you know, with my fist and at least play backbeats, you know, and it would get that bad occasionally.
Yeah.
But if you're playing, you know, Night Sprite and your arm goes numb, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was at the time I was playing with Hiromi, actually. And
right.
So I was playing some, you know, some heavy fusion music at the time, and I was having those problems, you know, and I was seeing my physical therapist on a regular basis, our buddy Dana Spellman. And I was, you know, using Tiger Balm patches, and like, I was on a regimen for my left arm. And so that was a big part of the fear at the time. And I had that sort of in general. It wasn't just about that, you know, filling in for Vinny. But, you know, along with the tendonitis, you put filling in for Vinny and playing this repertoire, yeah, it was daunting. And yeah. I'm so glad I didn't have to do it, man.
Well, I know, and I'm certainly not making light. I know that was a huge, like, I could picture you on the other end of the phone taking like four steps back when I called you, like, whoa, what? Like, you were honored, but you were like, I think you even said, like, Johnny, are you sure about this or something? I'm like, I have no doubt. And seriously, I know, you know, if it ever came down to it, you would have absolutely nailed it.
I would have gotten it done.
Yeah.
But I might not have slept the night before out of nerves. And I wouldn't have gotten it done as well in 2003 as I would now that I've developed. I've just developed more, you know, and I've improved my technique. I don't experience as much of that, not nearly as much of that actually, as I was, you know, almost 20 years ago. So yeah, I'd feel better about it now, but yeah, that was, I appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
You thought highly enough of my abilities to do that.
No, had no question. And we're, believe it or not, Dave, we're coming up on 2 hours and I know. And we started late because of my technical, difficulties, but you mentioned Hiromi and I want to set something up for you to tell a story, but you have a way better recollection of the dates than I do, but I know that I had told Steve Smith about you years ago, like probably in the late 80s, early 90s, and he kind of knew you as my friend, Dick DiCenzo's kid. And you know Steve well now, so you can laugh at that. But at the time, you were whatever, 20 years old, and he knew who your dad was, so you were like, yeah, your friend, Dick DiCenzo's kid. And then I think, I don't know, you must have met before. My wedding was 20 years ago this Thursday, 2001, June 24th. Kelly's, wow.
Was that Kelly?
That was Kelly, yeah. I just reminded her. She's forgotten that our anniversary is Thursday. So she's rushing out now to get a gift.
Yeah, right.
But I remember sort of either introducing or reintroducing you guys at the wedding and maybe even you guys hanging out a bit. And then the Hiromi gig, then you were playing with Hiromi a couple of years later.
Yep.
And you were in San Francisco. And I think he was planning to come see you, right?
Yes. It's an amazing story.
It is. You've got to tell the story.
So, I'm just thinking right now, like, do you know Michael Vosbeen?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think he's watching, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He told me how to fix my echo problem, but I don't think that's the problem. But thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. So Michael is doing these things called drummer stories, right?
Yes.
And I just did one for him, and this is the story I told.
Oh, great. Okay.
So I hope you don't mind, Michael. There's gonna be some overlap here. I won't tell it quite as excitingly right now for John as I did for you, Michael. Okay, I'll make it a little more drab. But this was an amazing story, man. Hiromi was still a relatively new artist. You know, she was signed and she had at least one, maybe two records out by now. I think she had her second record out. Mm-hmm. I played on her first record and I did her first tours. And then I left that situation because for various reasons, it had nothing to do with Hiromi. So she was still a relatively new artist. She and her management, I can only imagine, was trying to save, you know, pinch pennies, save some money. And I was subbing. So I was no longer in the band, but her drummer couldn't do a couple of dates out in the West Coast.
I see.
And one of them was at Yoshi's in, I think it's in Oakland, not San Francisco, but I flew
in. Yeah, Oakland, right.
So, so they book me a flight the same day of the gig from Boston, you know?
So, yeah.
And it's at the crack of ass in the morning, you know, so I had to get up at like 4 a.m., catch this flight out of Logan. They don't even book me a direct flight. If you're watching, Hiromi's manager, if you're watching, thanks a lot for that one. I really appreciate it. As highly as I can speak about Hiromi, I can speak as lowly about her management company at the time. So they booked me a connection at O'Hare. And so we're circling around O'Hare for long enough where I miss my connection.
Sure.
So, okay. So long story short, I'm like 3 hours late arriving in San Francisco. My car service is no longer there. I think I had a cell phone, like one of those like big clunky ones at the time. Yeah. And so I was able to make some calls, but I get to San Francisco and they have, so I travel with my double pedal at the time. I was traveling with cymbals and a stick bag. Mm-hmm. And of course, clothes, you know, a suitcase with some clothes, all of which had disappeared. By the time I get to San Francisco, none of that stuff arrived. So now, not only am I like 3 hours late and I have no car to get to the club, I have to wait in line to report my lost luggage and lost instruments. And now I got to get to Oakland from the San Francisco airport. So again, long story short, this was a crazy, like, I don't even remember how I got there. I think I took a train at one point, a bus, a taxi. And I show up, I finally show up. So on my way, I must've been in, you know, taxi or a train or a bus at one point. I call Steve because I knew he'd let me know he was coming to the show.
Yeah.
And he was already on his way to the gig. I wasn't even there yet. And I say, do you happen to have any sticks on you? And just as a matter of fact, yes, I actually have a pair of sticks in the back seat, something like that. And so, man, you know, it was so cool because the show ended up going so well. And, you know, Steve was a big influence on me, you know, so to have Steve showing up was quite an honor for me, you know, and I really, you know, we all always want to do good. You know, it could be the smallest gig or the biggest gig in your life. You want to do well, but now I've got Steve Smith, one of my, you know, childhood drumming heroes, is showing up to see me play. And I don't have my double pedal. And that was a big deal for me. I bring a double pedal. I bring my pedals because they're so important to me. Like I would rather do without just about anything else other than pedals. Like I need to feel that DW 5000 turbo feeling under my feet. It's a big deal to me. So I'm traveling with that and that's gone. My cymbals are gone. I show up to the club and they've got a pile of broken up battered sticks in the dressing room that drummers have left, you know. So thank goodness Steve has a fresh pair of sticks and they felt good in my hands. And that was another thing. Like, I hope they're not like 8 A's, you know, or these, you know, toothpicks. They felt good. They managed to get me a double pedal, which actually felt good as well. And the cymbals, I don't think they were great, but, you know, by that time, I told Michael this too. By that time I had I'd stopped caring.
Yeah.
Like I could have the worst gig of my life and I'm not even going to blame myself because this is a fiasco. And everything was like, we did two sets that night and they both were like killing sets. Like, I was really comfortable. I used Steve sticks the whole time. They didn't break. And it was just, it was awesome, man. It was a very happy ending to a very long and stressful day. Remember, I started at 4 a.m. in Boston.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I'm on the West Coast and, you know, we do two sets. So it's a long night.
24 hours you were awake, 24 basically.
24 hours, yeah.
Easily, yeah, yep. Yeah. I know what you mean. And I was going to, go ahead, sorry.
So it was just, it's just a cool story, right? Like, you're one of your drumming heroes just happens to be coming to see you play and you don't have sticks and he's got a pair of sticks and it's like, boom, you know, it worked.
And was that the first time, the first time he saw you play, right?
I think so. Yeah. I think remember actually him emailing you and you forwarded the email to me saying, man, I didn't know. I knew Dave. I knew Dick's son could play. No, he didn't say that, but I knew he could play, you know, rock and metal, but I didn't know he could, you know, play like jazz fusion with a trio. And, so yeah, I mean, you know, that, you know, I say this stuff because it's meaningful to me.
Yeah.
Like I'm not trying to blow my own horn by saying Steve Smith likes what I do. It was meaningful to me. Like you sending that to me and sharing that was like, you know, it props you up, you know, makes you feel more confidence and more motivation to keep going.
Yeah.
You don't want to let it prop you up in a false sense. You want it to inspire you to keep working, you know, and
exactly.
That's what it did. And so stuff like that.
Well, thank you for saying that. Thank you. And I was just going to say, I could never in a million years imagine you ever getting ahead of your skis with anything like that. And seriously, I knew you were just after hearing the story. I think Steve told me maybe before you did what happened and the horrible day that you had. So I just thought like, the reason I asked if that was the first time he'd seen you play, because I remember from that day on, you were no longer Dick DiCenzo's kid. You were Dave DiCenzo. And he became a huge fan of yours. And he sings to this day, sings your praises. But he was like, man, that kid plays his ass off. He was like, holy shit. You told me he was good, but I didn't. You're right. I think he thought like, in my little narrow world, I said, well, yeah, he's a great rock metal drummer. You should, you know, hear how fast he can play double bass drums. He saw for himself this wide, huge vocabulary that you at that point had and still have, obviously. So I really wanted to hear you tell the story because it's so great.
I love that story, man. That's why I shared it with Michael too for his podcast. It's the first story that comes to my mind if like somebody asked me for, you know, a cool story about my drumming career. That was a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Well, buddy, we should
stay, John. That was a long ass day.
It was a long ass day. I should let you get some of this beautiful. Is it, how's the weather up there today, by the way?
Actually, I forgot to open my window, draw the blinds, but it was overcast. Oh no, No, it's raining.
Oh, it is. Okay. I think it's going to rain down here later.
Yeah, I saw some sun out the back window earlier. It was looking nice.
Yeah, it's still sunny. It's beautiful. It was beautiful this morning. I saw a deer in the backyard when I got up this morning.
Really?
Yeah. Big one, too.
Do they bring the deer over on the boats and stuff? Are you in Edgartown?
Yeah, we're in Edgartown.
Nice, man.
That's a funny thing. We wonder the same thing. Like they swam over here, I don't know how many thousand years ago, but there's a shitload of deer. It's crazy. Yeah.
They must be expensive. You know, they got to import them and shit. And everything's
that's right.
Expensive over there.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah. But
well, I have a lot of history with the vineyard. You know, my parents had a timeshare in Vineyard
Haven right.
for 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah, my mom is just
you told me that.
To sell it, actually. She's gone down a couple of times by herself since my dad passed.
Oh, God bless Mary. Mary.
Yeah.
Wow.
She's amazing. So, the Vineyard is near and dear to my heart, man. I and Lori's too, because when we got together, we would take a week every summer from their timeshare because they wouldn't mm-hmm. use all their weeks. You know, they didn't always use all their weeks. So Lori and I got to spend some quality time, man, down there.
That's great.
It's just a beautiful place. I'm glad you're, are you down there for the summer now?
We're coming back Thursday, and then we go down. I have a gig Saturday in Marshfield, and then we have another gig next Thursday, the 1st of July, and then we come down on the 2nd, and we're here till more or less till September. Come home for a couple of days in August. Yeah.
Nice, man. What's the farthest north you get with your band? Like Woburn? Is that it?
Yeah, we actually Andover. We get up to Andover.
Okay. Yeah, I want to come see you guys sometime.
Okay.
I'm sure you've had a lot of drummers come see you.
I had a few come. Yeah. It's have you played Joe Rosenblatt came to see us a couple of years ago.
Nice. He just moved to Rhode Island.
He did?
Yeah, right? Isn't that strange? I saw it on Facebook or Instagram.
I got to reach out. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, to your point, Dave, it would be the same thing if you walked in the room. Joel had a gig that night at a place in Boston that, oh, God. Oh, that's Kelly playing her ride beat. The City Winery or some place like that in Boston. So he called to invite me to the gig. And I said, actually, my band's playing Saturday night at this Chinese restaurant in Wakefield. And he's like, give me the address. I'm going to come see you when I'm done with my gig. So halfway through the last set, you know, you can't miss Joel. He's 6'4" or something. Comes walking in, big smile on his face. And I'm like, you know, but he was so generous. He was so kind. It was great to see him.
That's cool, man. Yeah, I want to come hang sometime. I keep my eye out because I do see your posts from time to time. Grand Theft
Audio.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, we steal music, not cars.
Nice, man. Not well, but a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, you must sing well enough. I mean, you sing lead, right?
Yeah. Couple songs.
I could picture you singing. You got that silky.
Oh, you're a great singer too.
In your voice.
Thank you. And you're a great singer.
Thanks, man. I don't have any silk, but I can I can belt some scratchy shit out.
You got soul. You got huge quantities of soul.
Thanks, man.
Absolutely.
Johnny,
buddy, this has been
great, man.
Yeah, likewise. And I promise if it's not during the couple of days I'm back in the summer, at the end of the summer, we're going to have that face-to-face hang we keep saying we're going to do.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, me too.
I'll drive south. We'll hook up for a
bit. And I'll drive north. We'll meet somewhere in the middle.
Sounds good, man.
Cool.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Oh, thanks so much for doing this, Dave. This has been so great. I think you've given so much great. I'm looking at the comments here that you can look at later. Great inspiration, great information, and it's been fantastic.
Thank you, man. And again, it's really nice to be able to talk about my dad. It's it's really nice for me, especially with someone like you who knew him very well. It's nice.
Thanks, Dad. I mean, I'm saying thanks because I appreciate you. You know, wanting to talk about him as much as you did, and I really enjoyed that too. That was, I miss your dad like crazy.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Me too.
All right. Well, hang tight for a minute.
I still have your message, by the way.
Oh, wow.
You left a message the day he died. You left a voicemail on my phone and
I saved it.
I listen to it every once in a while. It brings a little tear to my eye and it's good. You know, it's good.
I'm going to get choked up. Wow. Yeah, man. Thank you. That is unbelievable. I told you this at the time. I know we spoke about it a bunch of times afterward, but your dad, and I should have said this at the very beginning, but I would say he single-handedly created this community that we now have, that we love, you know, of drummers in our area. It was your dad, man. It was he brought everybody together, and he still does.
Oh, that's so great. That's just so nice to hear you say that, man. Yeah. And I feel so grateful for the times that we lived through and that we got to experience, because it's different now. You know, I'm not saying now sucks and the past was great. It's just, it's different. And I feel lucky that we got to live that. And I appreciate you saying that about my dad. Because it is true. And you know, man, that's another thing I wish I got to tell him. You know, I hope in some ways I did tell him that I know what you've done, not just for me, but for our community.
I think you did, Dave. I really do.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, even if you didn't say it exactly like that, I think your actions and you, the human that you are, conveyed that to him.
I appreciate that, man. I hope that's true. And I'm going to choose to believe that. I'm going to choose to believe what you're saying. And thank you for saying that about him, because it's just nice to hear it. Somehow that makes me... Just hearing you say that, man, it just makes me feel good, and good. I appreciate it, man. He was
absolutely
hell of a dude, and he did give us a lot.
You're right. We can end it on that note. He did give us a lot.
Yeah. Cool, and it was good to learn. We'll end it on this note. It was good to learn for me that you actually knew him. That you had experiences with him before the shop and before Zildjian. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's neat, man. Well, you know, if we do this again sometime, I can share.
And we will.
There's still more stuff I can share about him, like his early days and him, you know, being, you know, working for the drum companies and him opening up areas.
Yeah, absolutely.
My mom has told me some cool stories.
I would love to hear those stories, Dave. So let's do another one of these at the end of the summer or in the fall.
Sounds good, man.
Yeah.
Sounds good, John.
All right, buddy. Love you lots. Love you too. Hang with me for 1 second, Dave. I'll end the live stream and then we'll hang in the room for a second.
Absolutely.
All right. Big hand for Dave DeCenzo, everybody.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Dave. See you in a second.
Okay.
All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right, again, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and I'll see you again real soon. See ya.